Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
And welcome to part two. You join us in the middle of our discussion on carrier design, and specifically the island structure.
Yeah, they did tend to be quite secure, the aft end of the islands. They did tend to be quite heavily muscled. But of course, the islands themselves are positioned exactly where they are because they found that it was natural for a pilot to turn to port rather than to turn to starboard. So you put your island where you do on the ship because it's more natural for the pilot to go the other way. Of course, the Japanese then decided what they wanted to do was have carriers operating alongside each other, so they would put some islands on the other side, and then they had a whole load of accidents. And they went, maybe the British were onto something, but we're still going to keep these ships because we like the idea. Because the idea was the two carriers could operate together and they could provide mutually protective overarching anti-air firepower and protection. So they'd all sort of basically operate as one unit. It's a nice idea.
When it was quite interesting, actually, when they abandoned the idea, one of the carriers actually, they'd already built the portside sponson for the island. And then they're like, oh, no, this is a bad idea. So we will have to move the island to the other side. But the sponson was already built. So that's one of the ways you can identify that particular carrier. I think it's Shikaku, if I remember correctly. You can identify it from Zuikaku by looking at a top-down view and noticing there's a little protrusion on the port side of the flight deck, and that means it's Shikaku rather than the other way around, rather than Zuikaku. Because I think Soryu and Hiryu had the alternating islands.
It is a fun idea, but there is a reason no one else was really going for it.
And the US was constantly trying to go with flush deck carriers. The amount of fight I've been reading about that the Bureau of Ships had to go through to get an island in place on the Yorktowns. And there were even a few people agitating for, well, actually, it's one of these weird things I found actually with the US Navy generally, that some of the weird ideas, most of the time, the designers who actually know what they're talking about managed to squash them. They didn't quite manage quickly enough with Ranger, so it ends up being not having a funnel as the vents on the back. But Yorktown, people try and make it flush deck. Essex, people try and make it flush deck. Not so much Midway, weirdly enough, although they do try and reduce the size of the island. But even by the time you get to the Forrestals, people are still arguing that maybe they should be flush deck instead of having an island. And again, they don't.
Wasn't there that huge America, the USS America, the big nuclear one, which is going to have nuclear bombers? That was flush deck, wasn't it?
Well, it was supposed to be, yeah. This thing, the flush deck argumentation after Ranger, they keep getting very close but losing. But they don't give up and go away. It's the same thing as in the run-up to World War One with the torpedo battleship. I think for about four or five iterations of US battleship design, you always have some helpful person standing there, but what if we made it a torpedo battleship? And every single time it gets close to a given degree of close, depending on the year, and then gets shot down. But whoever it is, they seem to hang around for an awful long time and not give up. They're determined to get
the same person.
Vision. Yeah, could be. So, yeah, I suspect whoever wanted the torpedo battleship would have loved to have met up with Admiral Beatty post-war when he tried to turn Eagle into the world's first torpedo aircraft carrier.
I'm
still not entirely sure what he was thinking when he decided I'm going to strap 18 torpedo tubes to HMS Eagle, and then it will do air operations during the day, and then at night it can sail into the middle of enemy cruiser squadrons and act as a giant destroyer. Are we sure he didn't get hit on the head at Jutland?
Are we sure he didn't get hit on the head before Jutland in Egypt or many of those other operations?
This is true. Yeah.
This is the thing with BT. I know Andrew does have reasons for defending him. Of course, those who listen to Andrew at the Andrew Lambert podcast. Mm. Andrew is far nicer about BT than me or Draka.
Mm.
Far, far nicer. And I think in many respects that's because possibly Andrew has mellowed with age, whereas we are still quite cynical and sarcastic.
Yeah, I mean, ironically enough, for the dry, extra long dry dock episode I've been recording over this week, there was a question of why I hated BT so much, and I did have to point out he does have some redeeming qualities. It's just none of them are qualities you want in somebody in charge of the battlecruiser fleet in the middle of a war. You either want him as a single ship commander or as a political operator post-war. To defend the Navy, because he's very good at that.
Yeah.
He's just not very good at leading capital units into a fight.
He's a good first Sea Lord, but he's not a good, well, within reason. He does let the RAF take the fleet era, but we'll leave that to one side. The interesting thing is, I was having a discussion yesterday about, on my videos, where it was done the live for World War One in the Far East. And the question came up, Von Spee was senior to Speer, to everyone back in Europe as a vice admiral. If he'd been back in Germany at the beginning of World War One, he would have been the commander of the High Seas Fleet, no problem. Frankly, he would have made mincemeat of BT. Jellicoe would have stood a chance against him, but Spee was bright and he was good, and I mean the German commanders weren't my biggest fan, because honestly I think they do make some very fundamental mistakes, but they're not slouches either, and BT sort of gets into trouble but sort of manages to escape for a bit of luck and for a little bit of judgment, but for a bit of luck. With Spee he wouldn't have had that chance.
It's one of these things, isn't it? A lot of the time with admirals, of you look at the most brilliant admirals, the ones who end up in the right place to use their specific talents. And then there's an awful lot of others who you can look at and go, well, they had the talents, they just weren't given the opportunities to exploit them.
Half the Russian admirals.
Yeah, a lot of the Russian admirals. And one of the ones I always keep coming back to is actually Admiral Sturdy.
Yeah.
Because, and again, I think I make this point in the dry dock episode, but to my mind, looking at his performance, yes, he wasn't the most popular officer amongst the other admirals, and Jellicoe was keeping him on a very tight leash because he had some very interesting ideas about how the Grand Fleet should be utilized. He's not the kind of officer you want in charge of the Grand Fleet, because he is the kind who would probably gamble double or nothing with it, which is not a situation you want when you have command of the sea already. But if you look at his performance at the Falkland Islands, once he actually gets into the fight, he knows exactly how to handle the battle cruisers. I think if you'd put BT in charge at the Falkland Islands, he would have charged into close range and tried to overwhelm Von Spee with close range fire, which might have worked, but would have ended up with the two Invincibles being probably quite badly shot up by the two Scharnhorst, because they did have decent gunnery. Whereas Sturdy, as I say, he knew exactly where to place his battle cruisers. He didn't have any particular compunction about, oh, well, this is very dishonorable. He just was like, no, I'm going to sit at a range where you can't hurt me, and I'm just going to pummel you until you stop moving. A very clinical way of looking at things. And so I've always said, I think the battlecruisers at Jutland would have done a lot better if BT had been in command of one of the divisions of the Grand Fleet and Sturdy had been in command of the battlecruiser fleet. Because he would have been a much more level-headed, much more rational commander, and would have probably utilized the battlecruisers much more to their own strengths rather than, apart from anything, he would have made sure 5th Battle Squadron stayed with them, because he was a great appreciator of mass firepower. He wouldn't have let them go wandering off through Bad Sigling.
There are many things Sturdy wasn't good at, but one of the good things he was good at communication, and he tended to have officers who could communicate as well.
Yeah, and that's
so
the thing
there'll be no Seymour issues, and if, you know, that's always the thing. Look at what Jellicoe achieves with barely any information. Imagine what he could achieve with actually getting the information he needs.
Yeah, yeah. And you look at the force that was available. It should have been 10 versus 5, with 4 of those being the Queen Elizabeths. That would have made the run to the south a one-sided slaughter, even with the issues with shells. Even if he did nothing more tactically inspired than just making sure Evan Thomas was actually in company when he headed south, that alone would have made Sturdy an infinitely better commander on the day. And at least to my mind, in the form of the battlecruiser fleet, he's got a force that's just big enough for him to utilize to the maximum extent of his capabilities, but not quite so big that he will be tempted to do something crazy like split his forces into a pincer movement like he wanted to do with the Grand Fleet. It's a very fine balance with him, I think.
Yeah, the only trouble is after Jellicoe gets promoted to First Sea Lord, then it's Beatty who becomes commander of the Grand Fleet. So, you know. But there again, if they've won a big enough battle at Jutland, if they've managed to, maybe you can then start dividing them into half and doing, you know, fancy Sturdy style maneuvers.
Yeah.
Or maybe Jellicoe manages to make sure the Sturdy doesn't succeed him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. Yeah, it's one of those big unanswered questions, but I do think poor old Sturdy gets a little bit of short shrift historically, mainly because he, for various reasons, managed to tick off a lot of his superiors who then wrote very unflattering things about him.
Well, he does like to ask questions, and, you know, people don't like being asked questions. Not even in the Royal Navy. Although, actually, no, it's interesting. It's some do, but some are sort of really... interesting when it comes to it. Now, I have to say, while we're talking about Sturdy, then we also should probably talk about Craddock.
Yes. Which, to be honest, they're both underappreciated, which fits with the overall theme of our topic this week.
Because Craddock, of course, gets beaten by Von Spey. Now, Von Spey is very, very good, and Von Spey has a far more powerful force, let's be honest. Von Spey has two pretty much new armored cruisers, a light cruiser and an auxiliary cruiser. Two armored cruisers and 3 light cruisers. Craddock has 2 armored cruisers, which are older, not nearly as light cruiser and auxiliary cruiser. And a sports was supposed to, have HMS Canopus, the old...
Yes, except that the Canopus's chief engineering officer was in the middle of a mental breakdown.
Yes, and all sorts of things had gone wrong with her.
Yeah.
You know, if he had Canopus, I'm not sure what I think in the nicest way. I think Spey would have probably seen, if Spey had seen Canopus there, he'd have probably gone, I think I want to be elsewhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, Von Spey...
And I can be elsewhere.
Yeah, I think he actually wrote that if he'd encountered Canopus, he would have just been like, no, I'm not fighting him. Because, and I think I've mentioned this when I've been talking about this before with Coronel, but... Yes, Canopus was slower than Glasgow and Monmouth and Good Hope, but it wasn't actually any slower than Otranto. So Craddock was being held up by Otranto. If the engineering officer on Canopus hadn't been completely off his rocker, then, well, as was proven when Canopus was making its way back round the Strait of Magellan, it could still hit 17, 18 knots. It was old, but its engineering plant was in surprisingly good nick. So it could have kept up. And then, the tactical brilliance of von Spey was that he was able to use his superior speed to hold off until the weather conditions favoured him. And again, this is actually another mark of a good commander in that he doesn't let pride or hubris dictate to him what his course of action is going to be, because he has the superior force. He could, technically speaking, have run in and won the battle at any point, but he still chooses to maximize his advantages by waiting for the exact perfect light conditions before moving in for his strike. And I think this is one of the things that when you're not in battle, you want an officer to be honourable. When you are in battle, you want an officer who's able to switch that off and become a purely cold, calculated killing machine who's going to work out exactly how to exterminate the enemy as swiftly and decisively as possible with minimal risk to his own ships. Because an officer who's a little bit too stuck on the honour system will either charge their ships in a tactically disadvantageous moment, which they might still win through preponderance of firepower, but with a lot more losses to their own name, or they might have a slight advantage and then throw it away and lose.
And this is, of course, the conversation which is about Craddock, because the question often goes, and I do love this phrase, because I quickly, just to check the ships, because I was listening to ships, open up the Wikipedia, just to make sure I got the correct number of the ships right, etc. And there has actually been put in there by Wikipedia, someone's written this, I'm not sure, you never know who, but it's a great turn of phrase. Given the Germans' period of speed, firepower, efficiency, and numbers, why Craddock chose to engage puzzles historians? Yes, it does puzzle some of my colleagues, I must admit. But it doesn't puzzle me that much, because you've got Trowbridge on court-martial for failing to engage the enemy. You've got the traditional Byng, but also you've got the fact that Craddock has an option. He can't run. He's not fast enough to run away from Spey. Okay? So Spey can choose to attack him when he chooses to, whenever he wants to. Now, both sides were expecting to encounter a single ship, but that, of course, didn't happen. The thing I think with Craddock is he knows he's outnumbered, he knows he's outgunned, but he also knows he can't outrun the enemy. His only chance with his gunnery, with his ships, is to get close. That is his only chance. You know, it's a terrible thing to think about, especially if you're a commander who's led your force there. And I don't think, from all my reading and study of Craddock, I don't consider him someone who's going to throw away the lives of his men, you know, on a whim. But his options are, I either try and run away and they can attack when they choose, or I try and dictate the pace of battle and try and go in as fast as I can, because I don't have the firepower. But, you know, my options are wait till he kills me when he wants to, or try, because my only slim chance, and it's a very, very slim chance Craddock has, of actually winning that fight and actually coming away successfully, is getting as close as he freaking can and blasting them as fast as he can.
Yeah, because the Monmouth has, it's an armoured cruiser with only 6-inch guns, but it has an awful lot of them. So it's horribly outranged and armor penetration wise outgunned by the Scharnhorsts, but it's the sheer number of guns, if he can get close enough and ideally drive the ship between the two Scharnhorsts at that kind of close range, he can probably pump out enough firepower to suppress them and give a chance for Monmouth with its two single 9.2-inch and its backup 6-inch to potentially land some pretty heavy shots in. So there is a possibility. It's a very outside possibility, but he does try and do the best he can, because when he realizes the situation that he's in, he does try and close the action as much as he can during the day when he would have some chance. It's just that this is the thing, the enemy always has a vote. Von Spee looks at it and he recognizes what Craddock's doing, and he realizes that this is the one tactic that could give Craddock a chance at winning, and he just decides, I'm not going to play that game, and uses his superior speed to stay away, at which point, unfortunately, Craddock, as you say, he doesn't have a choice at that point, because he can't run. Von Spee won't let him fight until Von Spee decides it's time to fight. And to be honest, actually, when it does happen, Von Spee still gets somewhat scared when he sees Monmouth and Good Hope come charging in, because he's perfectly aware of what could happen if they get close enough, bearing in mind that everybody's carrying torpedoes as well. And I know Von Spee notes that, if those two ships got close enough in and intact enough, he could be in a lot of trouble because they would have more rapid firing weaponry and could potentially launch torpedoes at him, which could be a big game changer. So he is absolutely determined to wipe those out first. And in large part, that's actually what allows Otranto and Glasgow to escape, because Wunschbay becomes focused on making absolutely sure, as any good naval commander should, that the two biggest enemy threats cannot get close enough to hurt him, even if that means the enemy light units escape. Because let's face it, Glasgow is good. It's the first town class. It's a very good ship. It proves itself later on to be a very good ship. But it's not going to win against three other ships. Even if it individually outguns them, it will get overwhelmed. But it manages to escape off into the night because of this massive focus on making sure Monmouth and Good Hope stay down. And Otranto just kind of wanders off doing its own thing because it's a liner and nobody really wants it to actually be involved in the fight.
No. But you see, this is the thing again. But imagine that the scenario gets turned on its head if you have Canopus there. Because then you have, of course, you have, what does Von Spee do? Because does he try and work his way around them?
Yeah, he hasn't got the speed advantage to get around them entirely.
Yeah.
Without going massively out of his way, and he doesn't have the fuel or the hull conditions for that.
And there's also HMS Defence coming up. So if he backs off and tries again later, by the time he gets by the time he does it, there's Defence, there's Canopus, and so there's now three armoured cruisers. There's, you know, there's all the things that Craddock could have had. And at that point, Craddock probably gets a bit of battle, a victory, and the Battle of Cornell is the great victory by Rear Admiral Craddock, who becomes Vice Admiral Craddock and probably gets a post somewhere else.
Yeah, and the thing is a lot of people point out, well, the Canopus class weren't particularly heavily armoured. No, fair enough, 6-inch main belt armour, but it's the same main belt thickness as you find on the Invincibles, and they would prove at the Falkland Islands to be more than capable of withstanding German fire at medium to long ranges. Yeah, okay, fair enough, a punch through at short ranges, but to be perfectly honest, no sane tactician, and von Spee was a very sane tactician, is ever going to take a Scharnhorst class armored cruiser into point blank fighting range of a Canopus class pre-dreadnought battleship, because that's just asking to have your ship shot through and magazines detonated by a 12-inch gun.
That's just the Canopus going, hello my pretty, come to me. You get closer all the time. I'd love it.
And not to mention, at that point, Canopus probably would have even gone for a ram.
Oh, yeah.
Being a pre-dreadnought, it would have had a ram bow built in and everything.
This is completely off topic, but going into World of Warships, I have a Bellerophon class battleship now. Mm-hmm. I have the first generation and the second. I have the Tier 3 and the Tier 4 battleships. Mm. I don't have any Tier 5 vessels because I've only just started recently and I quite like the Tier 4s. I'm having fun with them. And anyway, so my Orion battleship and my was actually damaged quite a lot and was pretty much going down. And I saw the enemy battleship was getting nice and close, so I decided to take her with me. So I managed to destroy one, but got bashed to blazes in the process of it. Because it and a cruiser and destroyer had tried to gang up on me. I managed to take out the destroyer, drive off the cruiser and sink the battleship, but I was wrecked. Another battleship coming in to wreck me, so I rammed her. So I got two battleship kills in that game. But sort of going, yeah, if she'd been a pre-dreadnought, I'd have a decent ram on her.
Yeah. Also off topic, but there is actually a ramming flag. It probably wouldn't have saved you in that situation, but for peer ramming, if you've got a lot of your health, the ramming flag gives you, I think it's plus 20 damage to the target, minus 50% damage to yourself. So battleship on battleship at full health, with the ramming flag, you can actually survive the ram.
Oh, cool.
And but, yes, of course, I am not talking from the voice of experience and in any way, shape, or form whatsoever.
Yeah, the other problem I have with World of Warships, and this, again, off topic, but it's me, is the amount of times you line up, you fire,
your shot to get ahead of an enemy cruiser or something from long range, because you're a battleship and you can do it. Or even when I'm a cruiser. And a freaking allied destroyer decides to wander straight across into the path. And gets it. And then you get penalty for shooting an ally. The limit thing. And, you know... And when a destroyer decides to cut in front of my battleship and gets caught, because we're both going at full speed, and I have tried to cram on reverse and everything, and I'm still going forward, and I sink it. You have sunk an ally. I know, it decided to run straight in front of me. There isn't really brakes on this thing here.
Did occasionally happen in real life as well.
Yes. It's not me being bad and being nasty and not liking my allies, although, frankly, if they're going to run a destroyer in front of me. I don't know. No, that is some fun history, though. There is some really interesting history where battleships do take out their own destroyers. It happened to a few tribal class as well.
Yeah. I think Punjabi ended up going that way with King George V.
Yes.
Unfortunately. Well, I'm going to fill in for Jamie and point out we are now just over one hour and a quarter in, and we still haven't talked about HMS Unicorn.
No, we haven't, which is quite good. But, you know, have we recorded all of that 1 hour and a quarter?
Yes.
That's the question.
That's what the timer on the recorder says.
Oh, good. Right then. So, let's do Unicorn. The reason I like Unicorn is because, frankly, it's a name which goes with quite a lot of fun things. So, we, of course, are going to be talking about HMS Unicorn, the aircraft carrier. But prior to that, there was HMS Unicorn in 1544, the 36-gun ship captured from Scotland. And then sold in 1555. HMS Unicorn in 1634 was a 56-gun ship launched then and then sold in 1687. So had a very interesting, actually, 53-year career. There is HMS Unicorn in 1665, also known as the Little Unicorn, which was an 18-gun fireship, originally Dutch service at Ebourne, captured in 1665, and only expended on the 4th of June, 1666, on the fourth day of 4 days' battle. So yes, people did keep fireships for a while. And the reason she was called Little Unicorn was because there was also an HMS Six Unicorn 1666, which was a 6-gun vessel purchased and sunk as a block ship at Chatham. Now, there's also HMS Unicorn 1748, a 28-gun 6-freight. HMS Unicorn 1776, a 20-gun post ship. Now, post ship is a interesting fast vessel designed to sort of get things around. She was captured by the French frigate Andromaque. In 1780, and then served as Licorne, recaptured by HMS Resource in 1781, and served as the Unicorn Prize. The reason she was serving as this was because in 1782, a 36-gun fifth rate was launched, which was called HMS Unicorn, but was renamed as HMS Talia in 1783. Then there's HMS Unicorn in 1794, which was a 32-gun fifth rate. And then HMS Unicorn in 1824 is a Leader class frigate, which is kind of a fun thing.
One of which is still up in Newcastle.
Yes. And then there's HMS Unicorn I-72, the aircraft carrier we're talking about, and HMS Unicorn, the Upholder class summary. Now, the reason I really like HMS Unicorn is I think actually it's a name which should come back into the Royal Navy, because I like having a ship around which is named after a mythical creature, which is basically a horse with a pointy bit on the end. It's kind of like, it's how little imagination do you have? Well, it's a horse and it's going to have a horn. We're going to call it Unicorn. Come on. But it's always to me, it's like sort of the pragmatist imagination name. And she's a beautiful ship. She's a lovely ship. But of course, she isn't an aircraft carrier. She is an aircraft carrier, but she's a forward maintenance support vessel, so she's not an aircraft carrier, which is very important for the treaty system. Which is why the Royal Navy was able to get her. So what do you think of HMS Unicorn before I start on my full rant?
As an aircraft maintenance ship, I think that the concept is definitely very sound. It's just, it's a shame that she didn't end up in the circumstances that she was actually specced for, if you like. I mean, apart from when she was with the British Pacific Fleet at the end of the war, that was kind of that she was finally in her natural environment, if you like.
And to an extent off Korea, during the Korean War.
Yeah. I think the idea of an aircraft maintenance ship as kind of backstopping your carrier fleet is definitely a very good one, because there are going to be limitations to what you can do. The illustrious class did have a maintenance and repair shop on board, but it's limited as compared to if you've got a support carrier like Unicorn, you can repair, recycle, rearm and reuse an awful lot more aircraft than you would be able to. So kind of the aircraft that might land vaguely intact, but on a normal carrier, you'd go, overboard with it. With something like Unicorn, you can actually say, we're going to stick it off to the side here, and then we're going to send it over to Unicorn at a later date and get it patched up. For a long-term sustainability of a campaign, it's certainly a very good idea.
It's actually something, the reason I want to talk about Unicorn, I think it's something that should be covered more, is because I think at the moment, in the world we're dealing with now, where we're going to have smaller and smaller air fleets as opposed to air groups. We have air groups on carriers. The carriers are mostly growing in size. The aircraft are growing in size as well. So the air group doesn't always grow that massively. But if you consider the Queen Elizabeth class versus the Invincible class, there's a big difference. But what you don't have is you don't have a lot of depth of aircraft. If we consider the number of Harriers the Royal British were operating in at the time of the Falklands War versus the number of F-35s were probably going up operating, that's a big thing. That's a big difference. And actually, I think, again, if you're talking about the Americans, if you're talking about all the allies who are operating aircraft, there isn't a depth of aircraft numbers there anymore. And yes, there is lots of talk about, we'll just rapidly build this or that or the other. I don't think we're going to be able to rapidly build things as quickly as we like. I don't think that's going to, I think if we do, that's going to be take a year or two to get going. So I think we should actually start looking at the idea of a forward maintenance carrier now. Again, the reason being, if you're going to support sustained air operations, you need to have something which you can take. Let's put it this way. There is, we could fly them off to a land base. Well, the trouble is, with a range of weapons, land bases aren't going to be that secure. And where you're going to be land bases, which you can do your maintenance. If you're talking about, at the moment, with the F-35, a huge thing's been made of the fact that Italy has got the maintenance facility and other facilities there, not in Britain, which is fine as a system to build during peacetime when you don't expect to have to fight a peer war. When you expect to have to fight a peer war, going, you know what, all our facilities are going to be in one base in one country, and all the air fleets from all these powers are going to have to defend on it, and that air base doesn't move, and, you know, it can only be there, doesn't seem like a good idea to me. Or no. have I now ranted to the point at which Drac is going, oh no, he's a really old one?
No, I actually agree, because apart from anything else, especially this is the thing. I think and this is perhaps where people get a little bit distracted from the point of a maintenance carriage in generally and in Unicorn in specific, which is that if you are fighting a lopsided war where the enemy either doesn't have carriers or has significantly fewer carriers than you, and basically isn't on a peer term with you, then you probably don't need it as much, because you're not going to be taking as many aircraft losses. And if you do take aircraft losses, you can afford to detach the carrier with the depleted air group back to get repairs and replacement aircraft from home and so on and so forth. Where the aircraft maintenance carrier really comes into its own is either when you are forced to fight very far away from your bases with a small number of your fleet because you can't deploy all your numbers, or if you're fighting a peer opponent or near peer opponent where having an extra dozen aircraft on the line 3 days into the massive slugging match that you're doing may make all the difference. And also in the modern era, especially when you're looking at potential conflicts in the Western Pacific, with modern precision guided weapons, anything that's a fixed airbase is also a fixed target and is very easy to kill. So it's all very well, say, for the US Navy to say, oh, yes, well, if we need replacement aircraft, etc., we can just get over to repair aircraft. We can just use Guam. In a full-on war with China, I don't think Guam's airfield is going to be in existence after the first 24 hours. Whereas a aircraft maintenance carrier is going to be a mobile target, which is going to make it a lot harder to hit and a lot easier to protect. Which in turn means that you can, the chances of you actually having the facility there in the first place to repair and your aircraft and restock your main carrier's flight groups after day two will actually still be there. It's all very well having an all-singing, all-dancing airbase that can do everything that an aircraft maintenance carrier can do and more, but if it stops existing for 24 to 48 hours into the fight, it's practically useless.
But the trouble is, it's going to be getting something like that built these days, isn't it?
Mm.
And actually, a long time ago, I came up with an idea, which was to use the solid store ships, which the British are planning and building, all three of them, and basically design them so they have a flat deck on the top and they have a single lift. And that can go down to I'd call the flex deck space, which could be used as a maintenance repair hangar or used for sorting out stores. And they would still have all the rigs they need for moving, transferring stores and that sort of internally. They just have a flat deck on top and a flex deck space, which could be used for a hangar space or used for maintenance. So you would have this sort of support facility.
I think the funny thing, before you mentioned it, I was going to suggest exactly that kind of thing. A large ship with a flight deck on top, with a hangar. And to be honest, actually, if you're going to go with something like a store ship, even take a leaf out, if you can justify building a big enough one, and let's face it, US Navy, they like big, so they probably can, take almost a leaf out of something like Indomitable and have a double hangar. Because then you've got two flexible spaces, so you can do massive amounts of stores or massive amounts of aircraft repair or half and half, or even upper deck is our aircraft maintenance repair rebuilding facility. The lower deck is full of spare parts, which gives you massive repair capacity, because it's got applications beyond just being with the hangars and the flight deck. You've got the applications far beyond your ability to just repair aircraft, because if you're using it as a storage ship, if you've got a hangar capable of moving, say, a couple of F-35s at a time, that's a hangar that's capable of moving sort of shipping containers worth of supplies at a time. If you've got the flight deck, you can fly vital elements out to various ships. If you need to, I know that like the V-22, I think the V-22 Osprey can carry things like engine blocks of F-35s. So if you've got a few of those stashed below decks, the V-22 being able to do vertical or short takeoff, it can just pick up an engine block, motor on over to the carrier, and that's one less engine block that the carrier's had to carry, which means that's more bombs, more missiles, more ammunition, more fuel that the carrier can carry. So the carrier is a more powerful offensive vessel at the same time. And when you're in the more mundane stores and supplies area, you can ferry supplies over by aircraft, or if you're going to need to transfer supplies the more traditional way at sea, then you can bring up significant amounts of supplies because you can store them in your standard shipping container or whatever on the lower hangar decks. And then you have kind of an onboard flatbed or two or four, and you just using the internal cranes. You put the container of supplies on the thing, you drive it onto the lift goes up. You now have hundreds of cubic feet of supplies, which you can now distribute across whoever's docked up near you.
And it would make things, it's going to sound strange. My theory was always that if you had this sort of, these internal hangar, I only had one, but yes, you could do two, but internal hangar space, sort of flex deck space, is that makes it so much easier because the stories of Michael Clapps of sorting out supplies at Ascension once they got there, because they needed to rework them because they've been packed as quickly as anything, and then they need to be resorted because they need to be loaded because they need to be loaded for amphibious assault and they need to be ships rearranged. But also, when you're on operations, think about that ship for humanitarian disaster relief.
Mm.
It's suddenly got huge spaces. It can carry huge amounts of stores. It can be used as mechanical shop, as a mobile hospital, because you can configure those internal spaces around that.
It's almost like you're reading my mind, because that was going to be my next option. Humanitarian relief and supplies. Because again, helicopter, like flight deck, you can operate B-22s, helicopters, etc. Massive amount of disaster relief capability there. Hangar space, again, if you can bring, if you can take on, and also in terms of fast storage, if, I mean, okay, let's put it back into a British context for something that happened a few, actually quite a few years ago now. Montserrat volcano goes off, instant reaction pretty much needed. When, if you've got military stores are one thing, everyone, like the military, the RFA will know how to pack military stores, but the kind of stores you'll need for humanitarian disaster relief for, say, a volcanic eruption are going to be completely different to what you're going to be using for day-to-day military stuff. But if you've got this ability to literally just roll on or crane on shipping containers worth of supplies with the little onboard vehicles that can take them to the hangars, take them down in on the lifts, you can load anything. You can load medical supplies, food supplies, fresh water, machinery, whatever, anything that will fit in a standard shipping container, you can get on board very, very quickly. And let's face it, a lot of modern dockyards are configured specifically to handle those kind of containers, and you can be off and on your way very, very fast.
And if you take the old idea that Unicorn had, one of the specific things she had was a lighter fitted onto her that could carry aircraft and a crane to take stuff out of it. Well, A, that would be quite natural to have the cranes extend in a way. In the fact, they extended over the stern on Unicorn, so they could do that, but in the thing. And also, having a lighter, well, we already have the Mexi float system, so we could have an advanced version of that that could be just strapped on the sides. Like we do on ships already, and then when she needs them, it's there. It can move, be used to take aircraft from a carrier if you don't want to fly the aircraft from a carrier to the ship and take it into the maintenance fund to sort it. All sorts of things can be done. And the other advantage for Britain is it would be an RFA, and you wouldn't have to man it in when you don't need it. It would be a case of RFA auxiliary going around doing the store ships routine. But when you need it, we can turn it into a humanitarian relief ship par excellence. We can turn it into a mobile hospital par excellence, because we can use those decks for a field hospital set on them. We can turn it into a maintenance carrier. It becomes an incredibly flexible asset to support the forces going forward.
Yeah, and it's, and because it's not a carrier, it doesn't bite into your strategic considerations. If you have to, if you're using it in wartime as a maintenance carrier, but let's say the war starts to go your way and its services are no longer required, or as you say, in peacetime, if there's a humanitarian disaster, if it, like at the moment, if there's a humanitarian disaster somewhere in the, well, Montserrat's pretty much done now, but let's say there's another hurricane, bad hurricane season in the Caribbean. Yeah, you can send Queen Elizabeth or Prince of Wales out, and you probably would, but you are still going to have to bargain that against the fact you're removing one of Britain's two big strategic assets from the table. And the Americans, even with things like the hurricane that hit Puerto Rico, they're still having to bargain against, okay, we could send an America class or a Tarawa class or a nuclear carrier out, and for humanitarian reasons we probably will, but we are still sacrificing part of our Navy strategic strike element in order to do so, Whereas with this, it's never part of that strategic strike to Galliman. It's never going to factor into those equations. So you're going to be much, much more flexible and quick in using it for all sorts of situations, as you and, as compared to Shanghaiing in a LHD or a carrier or a full-on carrier.
And there also the fact is, if you're building two or three, if you're building three of them, and let's say you can use them as the aid thing in Britain, you could probably get the aid, but possibly get the aid budget to contribute one as well, and still keep it RFA manned. You could have three or four even of these ships. So suddenly you have more store ships, more capabilities, but also you have more response. So yes, okay, I need one of them at least for each for the carrier when it's going around to support the carrier with its stores ships. But then I've got the other two. And then in wartime, if they are operating in the Pacific, where you will need multiple store ships, and this is what people don't understand, the store ship will turn up with the supplies, then we'll have to go back and get more supplies. And really, you want, while that's gone, you want another store ship turning up to give you, keep you supplies, keep your force going, because otherwise you're going to run out of things like, I don't know, bullets and food, which are kind of useful.
Yeah.
It does happen in war.
And in worst case scenario, when you're talking about peer level conflict, where all your forward island bases may well be smoking holes in the ground after a few days, given the fact that somewhere like the Pacific is very big, or even, to be honest, even if, well, at the moment the Argentinian government is relatively sane, but let's say in 5-10 years down the line, they get something along the lines of the government they had previously, to this one, who are a little bit more off their rocker, and they try something in the Falklands. We know the various issues that the Royal Navy had with aircraft and even the Royal Air Force as well, with the Vulcans having to stage all the way down there via Ascension. But if you've got something, then you're either in a situation where you don't have those forward bases, or you don't have the aircraft that can hop to the one or two forward bases you might have, or in a peer conflict where your forward bases have been destroyed. If you're operating at the very long end of a logistical train and you need replacement aircraft, you can even use them as mobile islands to hop your aircraft on. So, because let's face it, the F-35 A, B or C is not going to be making a trans-Pacific flight anytime soon. Whereas if you've got carriers hovering 400-500 miles off the Chinese coast, and after six rounds of combat, you're down to half strength and you desperately need more aircraft, but Japan has either had its air bases knocked out or has decided to stay very neutral, Guam's gone, maybe even Pearl Harbor might have been hit to a degree, and you can't safely stage F-35 replacements out of the US. If you've got, as you say, 2, 3, 4 of these, you could station them at intervals along the Pacific with some escorts. And these days, navigation to those points is nowhere near as difficult as it was in World War II. And it would be entirely feasible. I suppose at that point, you would be building it with a full length, probably a full length flight deck of some description.
If you're planning taking a C, whereas the British can do it with the Bs. And
with
that's
a B. More... yeah. But you can then just fly the aircraft. They land, they refuel, the pilot rests, they launch, they go on the next leg, however many legs they need to do until they arrive at your carriers. That is going to be vastly quicker, because even with a rest break and refueling, you could then get reinforcements and build up your carrier's flight wing back to full strength within 12 hours. As opposed to somehow having to ship them out on a container ship or something, or load them all onto another carrier and send that carrier across the Pacific. All of that would take days, whereas this way you could restock within hours.
And this is the thing. We do... The trouble is a lot of... And I suppose this is the big part of history which doesn't get covered enough in my mind, is that not enough attention is paid, especially when planning, to the fact that you are going to suffer losses. I look at the procurement strategy. You know, Britain is a classic example. We've got two carriers. That's not a procurement strategy. That is a very nice number for saying, yes, we can guarantee one available at all times. Well, that's okay until your enemy gets a vote.
You need to have the reserve of aircraft.
There's a reason why at in during the four, you know, we were building three Invincible class. Admittedly, they did try and sell them off to Australia, but after they found experience of Falklands, they decided not to, and they decided to build HMS Ocean on top of it. Not convert one of them to an LPH, but on top of that. So whilst keeping Fearless, Intrepid, and then Albion and Bulwark, they had four aviation ships. Why? Because that guarantees two available. The reason you needed two available was because you needed one for the carrier role and one for the amphibious role. Because the amphibious role usually involves you getting a lot closer to shore. And this is the final thing which it's worthwhile pointing out with these store ships. In any future amphibious operation, which does involve landing more than company, and I'm sorry to say this, but I know that there is a huge thing going on with the literal strike ships and all these things and the Royal Marines and everything. I'm fairly sure there will come a future where you need to land more than a company of troops. I am not sure how big a number of personnel it'll be, but I think it will be larger than a company. I think you would be talking a squadron-sized battle group. That battle group would probably be reinforced heavily by uncrewed units, especially if you're looking at the current army planning. And I am surprised no one's made the point yet that the future main battle tank will probably be entirely uncrewed and will be and there'll be a group of them operated from a nearby APC. That makes sense to me. That is probably the future. Because also the reductions you can make in the cost of a main battle tank, if you're not worried about the crew aboard, are probably something quite dramatic. But you're still going to land all those things. And you're probably going to want to get air support closer than you will necessarily want your carrier to get. With its loaded with strike aircraft and people necessary to keep those things working. So again, this storeship becomes your forward operating base. You can put near the amphibious operating zone or in the amphibious operation zone. It might even go in, you know, with the task group that's landing the troops. And it would be the lily pad for your carrier-based aircraft. They could fly there. They could refuel. They could rest. They could rearm there. Because that's also a big thing. We often talk about the fact that, aircraft, today, there's a huge debate the other day over air-to-air refueling. And the need to have air-to-air and buddy stores or things done in the UK Parliament and in the Commons Defence Solar Committee. And I was thinking, listening to it and going, that's amazing. Can we do air-to-air rearming yet? And that's the trouble. You're going to run out of stores. You're going to run out of weapons. And then your aircraft needs to go back to your carrier or needs to go back to your airbase. And that's a problem, especially as both those things are shrinking in number. But I think we are now possibly at the almost 2 hour mark, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yeah, 1:44.
Oh, so anything you want to add?
No, I think the only other thing I would add to that is that One of the multipliers it gives you, as you say, with it when it comes to landing, is the ability to sit there and go, actually, we can do this. And the reason I say, just being able to say yes, we are able to do this is important, is because, and it comes back almost to a point I made a little while ago about missiles. And the fact that once they get fast enough, you can mathematically calculate how many you need to overwhelm defenses based on the enemy's rate of fire rather than the capability of their missiles. And the thing is, once you actively limit yourself to we can only land X, anyone who wants to mess with you, knowing that you can only land X, can then work out exactly what they need to have in force greater than in order to make it impossible for you to intervene. Because if they know, let's say, you can land a company, okay, we'll have a division. No one sane is going to land a company into the face of a division, assuming that division is relatively well-trained. Or it could be a brigade or a regiment or whatever you want to call it. Whereas if you maintain this ability where you can say, well, yeah, normally we would land a company, But if push comes to shove, we can land this larger force, whatever that larger force size happens to be. A, that makes it a bit more unpredictable, but B, it also massively multiplies the amount of force your opponent will need to bring to bear, or potential opponent will need to bring to bear to stop you, which in turn means that the threshold for do we want to cause trouble becomes a lot higher. And once the stakes start escalating, suddenly people are like, do we want to make it that big of an issue? I mean, it's the whole thing with Argentina and the Falklands in 82. They didn't think that Britain would even bother, and they took to come to the Falklands defence, and they were also pretty convinced that they couldn't even if they wanted to.
Yes.
And that led to the Falklands War. If there's a reason the Argentinian junta didn't go after it in the 70s when you had Ark Royal still floating around, the Audacious class. Mm. And this is the thing, by having more capability, you actually ensure you need to use it less.
Yes.
Because, yeah, the Argentines might have looked at Ark Royal and gone, we might be able to beat it, but we might not. And either way, if we don't beat it, but we put the effort in, that's going to be a huge loss for us. And if we do put the effort in, it's probably still going to gut our forces. And even if somehow, by some miracle, we do manage to take it out, no one can really overlook the loss of a fleet carrier.
Yeah.
Even if the Audacious class at that point weren't the world's biggest. But it's going to escalate things further. And as a result, they didn't do anything. And it was only when that escalation and high level of resource commitment was out of the picture that they actually decided, yeah, we'll give it a go. And I think this is the thing, yeah, with these kinds of flexible ships, effectively, it offers you a force multiplier in so many different aspects. It makes it much less likely you're ever actually going to need to use them in anger, which, you know, in a lot of ways just will justify their cost, because yeah, it might cost you $1 billion to build one, maybe more. But how much is it going to cost you if you don't have them? And as a result of not having them, someone decides to start a war with you and you end up losing half a dozen ships. How much did that cost you?
Yeah, and I think probably $1 billion. I think £500 million, probably about, yeah. So probably about the same price, construction wise, unit cost as a Type 45 destroyer.
Mm.
Because let's be honest, the construction, the £1 billion destroyer remark made about the Type 45s, mm, includes the cost of development, not the cost of build, just the cost of building them.
Mm.
I do get annoyed when I see something like, oh, this is a £1 billion destroyer. I go, no, it's not. It costs £1 billion because they designed the research based on the concept of building 12.
Mm.
And then he built,
and they were
six,
promised more.
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons I think an E-class would be a good idea. The modified version that we've discussed a few times with extra, yeah, missile capabilities, effectively expanding on the Darings, and the Darings themselves could use a refit up to full capability, but the expanded E-class would, the R&D would be nowhere near the same because it's building on a pre-existing design rather than from scratch.
You think all the problems that we've spotted with the D-class that we talked about over the years could be quite easily, would we go, oh, well, we know them, so we can fix them.
Mm.
We might, there are certain things I'd like to see, like the phalanx replaced by the 40mm Bofors, probably, but you know.
Mm. And to be perfectly honest, if you build an E-class, the list of decent Royal Navy ship names is particularly strong when it comes to the letter E.
Yes, although Enterprise and Echo are already being used, but you could, you know, there's Excalibur.
Yeah.
Mm, that's quite fun. Echo's already in use.
Ooh, yeah.
I do like Echo. Echo is such a cool name for a Royal Navy ship.
Did they end up replacing Endurance?
No, they haven't called her. They haven't called her Endurance anyway.
Hmm. Yeah. So you could use that.
Yeah.
And Excellent. Yeah. Although is the school still there? HMS Excellent, or have they shut that down?
I think is it still there? I don't know. Let me check. That one I have to check because you know. Trouble is, so many schools have been wandered into other places. It's a stone frigate in Whale Island.
Okay, so it's still we there. Can't use that yet.
Emerald, it's still there.
You've got Emerald. Yeah. Emerald's a good one.
Yeah, Emerald is, I think, not in use, no?
Oh, Endymion. Endymion's always a good one to bring back. That's got a lot of history to it. Endymion Eclipse. Eclipse is just a good name generally. They're probably reserving Edinburgh for one of the Type 31s. Effingham. Actually, we were talking about him earlier. Bring Effingham back.
There is, let's see,
Euryalus, the machine gun Dido of World War II.
Euphrates.
Mm.
There's Express.
Eskimo. You could bring Eskimo back.
Oh, yes, could do. There's Esk. There's also, we could have HMS Escort.
I wonder what it'll be doing.
Escapade. Encounter. Electra.
Oh, yes, Electra.
And Eclipse.
Yep.
Or Exmouth.
So we've got plenty of E-class names to go with.
Yeah. That would work. And there you go. Simple way to build up the Royal Navy. Build, add six more E-class Type 40, E-class destroyers. Let's call them Type 46s. Mm. Or Type 45 Batch 2s. Get the Type 26s up to 12 units. That would be helpful. Then we could form six escort groups, each of two 45s, a 46, and two 26s. And 12 31s, so we can do the presence round of one. There you go. We have 36 escorts.
Yeah. Which is a nice divisible number.
And at which point, me and Drac could then start fixing the world.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, well, that's now 1 hour 53, so we should probably...
we should probably, because otherwise Jamie will be getting very upset about how much we've managed to talk about him.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you. Thank you. Hope you enjoyed. Thank you.
I will keep... And...
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.